Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Lisa McCormick from the University of Edinburgh about performing civility, international competitions in classical music. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm going to be talking to Lisa McCormick, who is a lecturer in sociology at the University of Edinburgh, about her new book, Performing Civility, International Competitions in Classical Music. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave.
So this is a really fascinating book. It's full of, I think, really important questions for the general sociology of culture, but also it's got some really kind of fine-grained detail about both music competitions and then the kind of broader contemporary classical music world as well. So it's a really rich and really interesting book. And I suppose the place to start is about where the book came from, you know, perhaps in terms of you talking through your own experience in this world and then how you came to write about it as an academic.
Okay. Well, music has always been a part of my life. I started playing the piano when I was 2, and I started playing the cello when I was 4. And I actually entered my first music competition at age 4. And because I was the youngest competitor that year, I found my way into the newspaper, the local newspaper. That way. And so from then on, I was in competitions regularly, and it was just a fact of life for me as a serious music student. And so it was something that, you know, I had a difficult relationship with, because I knew it was making me better, and yet it was very difficult to be putting myself out there in that way to be judged regularly. I was very relieved by the time I got to music school at the undergraduate level, because I realized that if I specialized in contemporary music, which became my passion, I maybe didn't have to put myself through that in order to have a career. Through various twists and turns of fate, I wound up becoming a sociologist, and I'd long forgotten competitions. But one day I was watching American Idol, and I thought, wait a minute, I know what's going on here. And it reminded me of how much everybody in the music world is angry about competitions all the time, how controversial they are, and what it is like to go through them. And it was just this eureka moment where I knew I could write something big, something serious that hadn't been done before and that needed to be said about the world of music.
Yeah, that I suppose disgruntlement or unhappiness with competitions is something that is really kind of central and important to the book. And it's something that I think is in tension to some of the ways that competitions like to kind of talk about themselves as well. And you deal with this a little bit in the introduction through both your theoretical perspective and then some central concepts. And the key one of these, which is obviously in the title, is this idea about civility. So what are you talking about when you use the term civility, and why is it so central to your understanding of contemporary classical competitions?
Right. Well, the reason why it's so central is because As much as I might have been slightly disgruntled or had a difficult relationship, we're all scarred by these experiences, even when we do well, right? I still won a lot of competitions. I had several trophies to show on the mantelpiece. I was best cellist in Canada at age 14. And yet it is something that you carry with you through your life. So it was more my curiosity about why it is that we have to have them. Why has it become so central to music life? Why is it that so many people have difficulties with it? And when you ask any professional musician what they think about them, why do they want to disown their involvement with it? And the more I thought about it, the more time I spent researching it as a sociologist, I realized it's true what they say about it being not just about music. And that's part of where the frustration comes from, is that it's not enough about music when it should be about music. But if it's not about music, what else is it about? And I found that prestige wasn't what it was about all the time, because the prestige was actually quite fragile and questioned at every turn. And so what I realized over time was that there was this higher aspiration that was driving the founding of these institutions, these organizations, and also the principles that they were trying to achieve in the way that they'd set them up and the way that they devised the rules was more about civility. And I was using civility in two senses, in terms of what the organization is and what the function of competitions are in the music world. I was thinking about it mainly in terms of the cultural codes and the integrative patterns, as well as the institutional procedures that characterize this social realm we could call the civil sphere. And in a way, this is why competitions were special, is because it's a place in the music world where everybody thought fairness mattered, whereas fairness is not really what matters in other realms of musical life. It's about who is the best and what best serves the art, not about whether rules have been respected. And so I think this was a source of the tension and the controversy that was going on. But I was also keen to understand civility in the sense, more in the sense of Norbert Elias's civilizing process, where, you know, Western classical music and these great canonical works are seen as particular forms of, you know, rationality and emotional control, but also emotional expression of a certain kind. And so understanding how these two things work together, how it is that musicians can show their civility in both senses of having control over the body and control over emotions, but also understanding how to interact with opponents in this very high stakes environment.
And this obviously relates to the idea of the performance perspective, which is the kind of theoretical framework that you use. And you devote a bit of time both at the end of the book and at the beginning of the book to explaining that. So why is that your preferred approach for understanding these kind of exercises in civility?
Oh, yes. Well, there were two reasons really driving the choice of the performance perspective. So one aspect is that, you know, competitions, what are they judging? Music competitions are judging performance. So if this isn't central to your explanatory framework, then what are you doing? And I also found that it was completely unsatisfactory to go to the usual kinds of concepts that sociologists would grab for, being, you know, this is about marketization and, you know, the professionalization of an industry. That's why there's more competitions. Well, the more you looked at that kind of argument, the more it didn't hold up. And as I mentioned earlier, the prestige argument wasn't holding up because there was so much doubt about whether or not these mechanisms were actually working to identify talent. So a performance perspective lent itself well because it was highlighting what was kind of the central concern for the music world and especially for these institutions. And in terms of the sociological kind of payoff, analytical payoff, it allowed me to remember power, but not reduce everything to power. So a kind of social performance perspective that's based on the cultural pragmatics first developed by Jeffrey Alexander, allowed me to bring into play six elements of performance, one of which is power, which gave me, I thought, more leverage in terms of understanding what's going on.
The book then follows, I suppose, kind of two parts. One is to really give us a history and to situate the competition, and then is to think through the various characters or participants, both competitors, jurors, and audiences.
Yes.
And I wonder if we might take a bit of time to think through what you do in Chapter 2 and Chapter 3, which is explain both the rise of the music competition, the kind of challenges and almost the kind of breaking points for these competitions, and then how they were changed, reconfigured, and how they now narrate themselves, particularly using that idea of civility.
Yes. Well, in a sense, the history part of the study of the research was motivated to answer the production of culture people. I wanted to make sure that I had a solid understanding of why it is that competitions look the way they do today by going back and trying to understand their predecessors. And, you know, of course, this is a very long history for, if you want to think about art music, you know, there were competitions in ancient Greece that were, you know, poetry, sung poetry. I became very interested in the role of competitions in the confraternities in medieval Europe. That's the other kind of predecessor, but those were very different beasts because that was, centered around feast days. These were religious societies, and it was because musicians tended to be outcasts that their way of celebrating a saint's feast day and belonging to the society that would give them burial rites, it kind of made sense for them to make this their major event when they gathered once a year. And these became international and all that. And those morphed into more trade union type organizations over the centuries. But that has very little relationship with what it is that all musicians today think of as a music competition, because then it was more the music that was being judged. Now it's more the performance being judged. And this new creation of an organization that exists for the sole purpose of having an event where people apply to participate and a jury of international figures are invited to make the deliberations and choose winners. This was invented at the same historical moment as the Olympics reinvention in the 1890s and also the Venice Biennale. So there was kind of a moment of internationalism that was happening then. And this is, I think, the important kind of turning point in the history of competitions, because it thinks of itself as primarily bureaucratic and as open to all musicians. The only restriction is age, but they can be any nationality, any ethnicity, any religion, which was very important at that time, and they would be judged according to how well they played. And it also didn't matter where they studied. So this was an important turning point, and this became the kind of format that, you know, was changed because, you know, the world changed and the macro political context changed. But the idea of this bureaucratic organization remained, but it was always slightly susceptible to polluting influences, right? The idea of being open to anyone from anywhere in the world was there, and yet because they tended to be founded by these charismatic figures, often as a kind of protest towards what they thought of as a selection mechanism that was not often finding great talent and disenfranchising or overlooking some portion of the music population, they tended to operate independently, which was great, but it also made them susceptible to becoming new kind of centers of clientelism, but also getting caught up in political rivalries.
How then does this sort of challenge get overcome? What kind of things do we see in the contemporary competition that sort of answer those challenges and criticisms? One of the things you talk about in the third chapter is the kind of stories that competitions try and tell about themselves versus the kind of presentation that we see in the media. And then later on, you know, these kind of things get raised with individual competitors or jurors or audiences' kind of critiques too.
Right. So there were kind of what I thought was interesting and what I tried to do in the book was to have both a kind of institutional story, but then also the kind of public cultural story of how competitions turn things around. Because in the first part of the 20th century, they really were susceptible to becoming an arena in which cultural superiority was demonstrated by hostile countries, especially, you know, as the Cold War was starting to gather steam in the late 50s and early 60s. It was all about East versus West. But in the 50s, with the founding of the World Federation of International Music Competitions, there was this institutional commitment to cleaning up the act and preventing politics and clientelism from ruining what could be a really important and force function in the music world. So there was this story that I think is kind of amazingly impressive, that all of these organizations kind of got together and decided we should police ourselves and make sure that we don't let these polluting influences take control. So that was going on behind the scenes, but kind of in front of the world, in the way that these events have always been intended to be media events attended by a general public. You know, these aren't auditions behind closed doors. They want a public there to be able to see the selection of the ultimate winner. And of course, the press need to be there to make sure that the world is informed of this great talent, that competitions see themselves as existing to find. Hopefully, sometimes. So what I've noticed in looking at a lot of the famous competitions is that they, of course, present themselves like competitions are also themselves performing. And so in their publicity materials and in the way that they present themselves to funding bodies, to other cultural organizations, to government organizations, to their peers, to the music world, they want to be seen as this organization that provides this forum where, you know, a great artist can be found, and that this is a very moving and powerful ritual where everybody can be involved and enjoy this kind of special moment of a star being born. That is how they want to be seen. That is what they want to happen. But of course, the press want to be more than just witnesses to this. They have their own independent set of ideas of what great artists are. They also have their own means of publicizing who they think was playing well in this particular event. And they also, as journalists, tend to have a critical eye towards these institutions. And so they're not shy about questioning whether the organizations are performing this role, whether they might be ruining classical music, damaging young performers, and overall encouraging, shall we say, unfortunate trends, conservatism in the repertoire, expectations of perfection in the audience. And so the journalists have their own kind of default narrative framework where they are inclined to have a profaning discourse, a cynical discourse. But sometimes they get caught up in the excitement too. And they see the event unfolding in terms of a story, either this mystical ritual where this amazing talent of the generation is found, or they can see the competition as this kind of symbolic forum where politics is transcended through this great music and these acts of civility. And the most famous example for that is Van Cliburn, a Texan, winning the first Tchaikovsky competition in 1958.
Yeah, you devote quite a bit of discussion to that. It's really interesting, the comparisons you draw with things like sport and the ideas of kind of masculinized competition and combat and these kinds of things. It's a really interesting example of precisely that tension between these different ways of narrating the competitions. We might turn now to how some of these ideas get played out on an individual level as the rest of the book moves through the questions of the competitors, the jurors, and the kind of the public and the audience that are bound up with these competitions. So to start with the competitors, who are these people? You kind of list a series of ideal types: prodigies, virtuosos, heroes, intellectuals. And how is gender important to understanding the experience of the competitor?
Well, I was interested in that chapter, that big chapter, to get into a kind of Goffmanian analysis of how competitors present themselves in this context. Because, you know, when we're talking about international competitions, we're talking about the highest level. These aren't young people. Like, they are young people, but, you know, they're not kids.
Yeah.
18 to 32 year olds, some of whom are already professional, and who have dedicated their lives to studying this instrument or playing, you know, quartets, and so they think very carefully about what they're doing. And I wanted to get inside how it is that they present themselves in this context, because it should be the same as every other performance context they encounter, and yet it isn't. Because what kept coming up and talking to them is how they felt like they were compromising their morals. But what I saw from the way that in looking at what they use, both their musical means of production, their choice of what they play and how they play it, as well as how they present themselves physically on stage, there is kind of a set of ideas or images or notions of genius that they kept kind of indexing, that they were trying to embody, so that the audience and the jury could recognize that they might be deserving of a title. And the ones that I found were most common, these notions of genius that I just saw coming out all the time, and that audience members or other competitors would say when this person would come on stage and play certain pieces, they'd say, "Oh, look at his choices for, you know, round three. He definitely wants to be seen as an intellectual." So this was how people were spoken of. And also, you know, through my own experience, this is what I'd seen my whole life, is the kind of strategies for being recognized as a genius. But also what came through in observing this more systematically was how some of these notions of genius are more easily embodied by men than by women. And when it came to recognizing a female performer's greatness, there were some images that came up all the time, and some that just they kind of could never be associated with them. So it's one thing for women to be a prodigy, because, you know, being young and small and seeming to be moved by something else was a very common occurrence, and also very virtuosic women as a kind of fire-breathing virtuoso happened, but this tended to be spoken of in terms of them being seductress, whereas the more kind of intellectual idea of genius, it was very difficult for women to engage, and there was kind of a resistance amongst the audience to recognizing women in this way.
Yeah, the chapter's full of these really brilliant quotes about the unbelievably kind of minutiae of things like bowing and the decision to bow or not bow, and, you know, like how people's particular dress styles gave out codes that they, you know, perhaps weren't serious musicians, so shouldn't be judged in a particular way. And what's really interesting about the richness of the empirical material is it really kind of challenges the attempts at kind of bureaucracy and transparency and judging, because there are lots of little, you know, kind of codes that are referred to about, you know, jurors basically making decisions almost on how someone carries themselves onto stage, and performers talking about, you know, getting the edge because of, you know, the way they, you know, their deportment or something like this. So, and to move on, you know, to our questions about jurors, is like, how are jurors kind of making these judgments? How do they do the act of commensuration between these unbelievably, you know, talented and highly skilled people?
Well, and that was the other kind of fascinating finding, was that, you know, I was talking to judges who are, again, at the very top of their field, you know, have, their entire lives have been spent studying this repertoire. You know, they're famous recording artists, concert artists, famous teachers, all this. And yet, when it comes to judging, it's not something they find easy to do. They really struggle with it, not because they don't know what they think. Of course, they know what they think. But there's something, again, about the context that problematizes what they do every day for a living. And the way that I explained this was by drawing from Espelin's wonderful analysis of commensuration. So I, in interviewing jurors, I found that there were kind of three problems that they kept struggling with. And also, you know, talking to directors about how they've tried to manage and come up with better voting systems. There are just kind of three unavoidable problems or challenges, if you will, when it comes to judging. And the first one was that jurors were asked to translate their impression of somebody's playing into a score, into a numerical figure. And that is a difficult process because there's no perfect way to codify that. And because these are elites at the top of their field, it's kind of insulting to try to codify it for these people. So in a sense, it's impossible to standardize. Even within a competition, but there's definitely no standardization across competitions either. So you have this issue come up immediately that no matter how many competitions you've judged at the highest level, each one is going to be different, and each competition might change over time. So there's no being able to accumulate experience in that way. And then there's everybody's individual way of translating the impression to the score. Then you have the difficulty of comparing the different players, who are very different kinds of players, and often playing very different repertoires. So you, it really is the cliche of comparing apples to oranges to pomegranates to any other vegetable you want to think of. So there's that problem, and you know, trying to contain that by having some pieces be the same, so that you actually have a little bit of reduction of variation, is one strategy. But of course, that makes it a very tiring experience for any audience that's there. You know, the judges don't mind because they're used to that, but if you want a public, they find that very boring. And finally, you have the difficulty when it comes to the final deliberations of harmonizing tastes. So, you know, one of the pleasures of being in the arts, and definitely in classical music, is to have very different reactions and responses and tastes, or how you like your Schubert played. And that can change day to day, you know, within reason, of course, but trying to make those harmonize is the goal of the competition. And yet that's not the way that musical life evolves in any other situation in which these professionals find themselves. And so trying to adjudicate that is the challenge of competitions. And they're constantly drawing back to those ideas of civility about what fairness is, how to be as objective as possible, so that they kind of meet this aspiration being this kind of institution where these integrative patterns and cultural codes are respected and met. And yet it comes at the expense of these kind of aesthetic ideals or aesthetic ways of being.
One of the things that struck me reading this particular part of the book was the irony that so much of it seemed to be what we see played out, you know, on television on a Saturday night, you know, the kind of ostentatious eye rolling, or, you know, passive aggressive, you know, forms of writing by jurors, you know, to signal that they're bored or whatever. And then, you know, other jurors speaking out in defense of candidates who have been unfairly judged, and, you know, and this kind of performance that we, you know, really kind of would be quite cautious about connecting to the kind of, you know, Elias Development of Civilization narrative, and yet is kind of shot through with the, you know, the kind of involvement of the audience or the public. And this obviously is the source of the discussion in the penultimate chapter of the book. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about the two terms, the idea of the public and the idea about the audience, before we maybe move on to talk about Adorno.
Sure. Well, and this was, you know, for someone like me who spent most of their life thinking they were going to be a professional musician and in competitions constantly, attending these events as a member of the public was completely new to me, because, you know, I'd only ever competed in them. It was kind of an ethnographic choice to do my study by attending as a member of the public, so that I experienced and saw it from this other side. And one of the things I had no idea as a performer was how much the audience talked. And it wasn't just friendly chit-chat, how's your mother stuff. As soon as a performer stopped, it didn't matter where I was in the hall. It didn't matter if I'd ever, you know, strangers would turn to me and demand an opinion of what I'd just heard. And I had not encountered that before. When I go to concerts, that never happens. But when I go to competitions, it happens every time. And there is heated discussion. And, you know, there are groups of friends that attend and compare notes during the intermission. They go out for dinner together to argue about who they think should win. There is intense scrutiny and analysis of results at every stage of the performance. Sometimes this spills out online onto online forums that are sometimes hosted by the competition, sometimes not. But there is all of this activity. And so that's what I'm trying to get at, between the difference between an audience member and a public. Because, you know, here I look to the great critical theorists to understand, to think about the audience as you know, the kind of receiving role, right, being attending to the artistic event. And, you know, that's a critical role, because without an audience, and, you know, also in the performance perspective, if you have a symbolic display, if you're displaying the meaning of your social situation, it has to be for somebody. And, you know, while at competitions it's complicated because there is a jury who is the main audience in some respects, it isn't a public event. It wouldn't be a competition if they didn't have other members of the public there. But to the difference for me between this audience and the public is that people who attend competitions become a public when they start to debate, when they want to talk about why a performance was better than another one, but also the bigger questions about who is on the jury, should they be on the jury, what are they taking into account when they're making these decisions, right? So they really are questioning every aspect of the institution, and they're really invested in it being right. And they too keep referring back to these cultural codes of civility to critique the organization, because they only want to kind of invest and support a decision for an organization that they think has done things in a justifiable, honorable way.
I'd like to kind of probe that a little bit more, actually, because one of the things that we've done in our conversation is give a sense of, I suppose, the kind of empirical elements of the book. The book is full of really rich theoretical reflection, and I think maybe one of the ways we could start to conclude actually is on a particular theoretical intervention you make in this chapter, which is to speak, and, you know, you kind of touched on this already, which is to speak to the work of Theodor Adorno and you know, the kind of ideas you've been talking about, that someone like Adorno, you know, is kind of bound up with, but also is quite critical of. it is something that you try and build on and almost kind of reconsider and reconstitute. So I wonder if you could just illustrate the sort of theoretical work you're doing with your use of Adorno in that chapter six.
Yes, well, I know I'm unusual as a sociologist who's sympathetic with Adorno because I understand why his reputation is what it is, and there are some unfortunate arguments that he's made, but I think that it's a bit of a baby has been thrown out with the bathwater situation with Adorno, because there is still, I think, something to be retrieved. So this was my somewhat more provocative argument in this chapter, is to kind of retrieve and rehabilitate his infamous typology of listeners, because this is one of the pieces of his work that is often, you know, kind of brought out to show that this man is a horrible elitist, because he creates a typology that seems to imply a hierarchy of listeners, and of course at the top are people who can listen like him, because he can understand the structure of the musical text being presented. And he, of course, denigrates listeners who are more interested in the kind of emotional experience that they might have triggered by listening to music, or even worse, cultural, you know, people who are more like culture consumers who focus on the wrong bits, right? They focus on the trivia, they focus on the, you know, they're the ones who are fascinated by virtuosity and they don't understand anything about music, and they're kind of manipulated by the wrong stuff, and right. So basically this is a highly critiqued typology of his, and yet I thought there's still something to this here, because when I was observing and thinking about what it is that the audience is doing when they're there, there were, you know, kind of identifiable subject positions. So I like the idea of there being a typology to describe a kind of orientation you can have to this competition event, and you can shift in and out of these over time depending on how the event proceeds. So I retained some of what Adorno was talking about there, because some of these listeners are really only concerned with how the music was played. And they are, when members of the audience get together and talk about what they liked about a performer, they're really only talking about, you know, how fast the second movement was, and, you know, all of these kind of details that are, you know, much more kind of musician, technical, specialist concerns. But then there are other people, you know, or they get caught up in another aspect of the event, and they move into a different subject position. So they can find themselves becoming more of an emotional listener. And also to remember that there are the audience also contains people who have different functions in the competition itself, and that this can affect their experience of the competition. So if you are, which is very common in many competitions, hosting one of the competitors, it kind of, you have this, it doesn't take long for this intense kind of bond to form, where that feels like a member of your family. So your orientation to the event is primarily emotional. And if that person gets eliminated, then you do become what we could call a resentment listener, because you feel like it's been spoiled for you, and you can't really come to be rooting for any of the other candidates. And depending on one's level of technical proficiency and background in music, and depending on one's role in the proceedings, if you're trying to be neutral, if you don't want to be neutral, you will move in and out of these subject positions.
Yeah, and it's a really useful way to both, you know, kind of mount a little bit of a defense of Adorno, but also to show us how these kind of grander sociological theories can explain, you know, the sorts of moments you were talking about in terms of people asking you, what did you think, you know, like gives your comments, and that kind of explosion of discourse. You also talk about this explosion of discourse online as well. So it's both a kind of, I think, a useful sort of illustration to people of where these kind of grander theories can be useful, but also it allows you to put exactly your ideas in interplay in terms of your own experiences of being at the competitions. I think we might finish with precisely the question you ask in the conclusion of the book: what is the future of music competitions? And interestingly, that conclusion is very, very short. It's only sort of two or three pages long. So I wonder if you could just kind of summarize that as a way to finish.
Yes, well, it is the question for not just the people who run these organizations, but musicians themselves, because it is it's always been a competitive field. It is difficult to become a concert pianist or violinist or cellist, right? This is not an easy scene in which to make a name and have a great international career. So part of what's fueling that question, or making it an urgent question at least, is concern amongst musicians today about how it is that they can have a life in music, and whether competitions will continue to play a role in helping them to have a life in music, because that has been part of, you know, the critique of competitions in the past, is that they're becoming too important. And, you know, if they aren't civil, if they are damaging, then should they be playing this important role in helping us discover, you know, talent and in helping people launch careers? But of course, with the proliferation of competitions, now there are a lot of them, and with a perception that other ways to make careers in the world are shrinking, what happens if there are no more competitions? So that's a lot of what's going into why the question is raised all the time. And when it comes to answering it, I spoke to the president, then president, of the World Federation of International Music Competitions. And it was interesting that his answer was very much a kind of mixture of Bourdieuian and a kind of economistic answer, where, you know, there is a need for this. As long as there is a need for competitions, there will be competitions. And the selection mechanism role is what's going to keep it in play. Except there's always the danger of the debasement of the currency of the prize if there are too many competitions. So he anticipated that there would be a greater kind of refinement of the hierarchy of importance of competitions, but that that as long as people wanted to compete in them in order to try to get into better music schools, better festivals, better agencies, whatever, they would be there. But my answer was slightly different, because what I'd seen in going through the history was that what made competitions have any kind of shelf life, or no, not shelf life, but existence, long-term existence, was that they were founded by a charismatic person. That this was really, for me, a question about the institutionalization of charisma, because when competitions were founded by somebody like Eugène Ysaÿe, who was a world famous violinist and who was not shy about explaining why he thought there needed to be a competition that was different from the competition system in conservatories, and had his own ideas about how best to identify talent that included things like take them away from their teachers for a week and make them learn a new piece from scratch. You know, he really innovated these ideas, and then also had the support and the connections to make that work, to create a place where you could segregate violin for a week to learn a new piece. And if this generation, you know, Ysaÿe is a while ago, but still, if these charismatic figures are not replaced with another set of charismatic figures, then, and they will become truly bureaucratic organizations, and then I'm not sure they're going to have a place. So it isn't just their function that matters. It's how they're characterized and how they're understood and kind of pushed by another force in the music world.
And it, yeah, I mean, such is the great kind of dilemma for so many artistic and cultural organizations in the modern world. Are you going to be doing more kinds of work on this in terms of papers and books, or is your sort of cultural sociology moving in a different direction, or are you doing something completely different at all in terms of your future work?
Oh, well, I both, actually. So I've been I have two kind of spin-off projects from the book. One is very closely connected because I've at the invitation of the Chopin Institute, which is the organization that hosts the International Friedrich Chopin Piano Competition in Warsaw, I started to get interested in the kinds of scandals that happen in competitions. And so I will be doing a much more closely focused analysis of the famous 1980 event of the piano competition in which Ivo Pogorelich was eliminated and Martha Argerich resigned from the jury in protest angrily and, you know, went to the press and explained why. And so I'll be doing a kind of closer analysis of this to work towards a typology of scandal in the music world. So I'll start with what I know, which is competitions and why it is that they're prone to controversies and what kinds of controversies emerge in this context and maybe work from out from there. To other kinds of scandals in the music world. The other project I'm working on that's related to the book is on symphonic diplomacy, because I'm very interested in this idea of, you know, competitions are one way to create a symbolic forum where politics might be transcended and where marginal groups might show that they too can be part of the kind of the public, the musical public, or, you know, the civil sphere. Well, symphonic diplomacy is another place where that can happen. Doesn't always happen, but could happen, or at least they're trying to make it happen. And so I'm interested in why it is that orchestras are sent around the world to improve relations between nations and in the post-Cold War era. So that's kind of what's growing from the book. But in the meantime and in between time, I've been getting interested in music and death, and more specifically, the expanded role of music in contemporary funerals, why it is, especially in the UK, that we hear such a wide variety of music in these intensely emotional ceremonies. So I've been looking into that, you know, both the kind of technological aspect of, you know, what are the legal and also technological innovations that have allowed us to have so much more music, and also kind of the professional industry changes that have made music more important and yet have changed the set of people who are involved in deciding what is played and why exactly it is that music is one of the more fraught choices for a funeral.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. In this episode, I was talking to Dr. Lisa McCormack from the University of Edinburgh about Performing Civility, International Competitions, and Classical Music, which is published by Cambridge University Press.